You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since Deb Perlman launched it in 2006, the Smitten Kitchen blog has developed a major cult following. Late last year, her first book, called The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, was published by Knopf. It quickly became a bestseller. And if the reaction of our listeners when they heard that she was coming back to our show is any indication, Deb, her blog, and her book remain incredibly popular. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you. That's quite an introduction.
You've described yourself as obsessive. Do you think that one of the reasons that your recipes are so popular is that you're obsessive in crafting them to work?
I hope so. It's a little bit of the obsessiveness is trying to get them to work, and a little bit of the obsessiveness is trying to get them to work for home cooks. This idea that, you know, so many of our recipes are written by chefs and restaurant cooks, and they make amazing, incredible food. But when you're at home, the rules are different. You don't want to have to do 20 pieces of prep or use 3 pots or 2 bowls. And so I'm always asking, like, can we make this cake in 1 bowl? Do we have to brown? Like, does it change the final dish enough that it's worth an extra dirty dish?
Also, I think I go to a restaurant for the kinds of food that I don't cook at home. Often the ingredients that I won't necessarily use at home, I'm looking for something different at home.
Exactly. I love, one of the things I love at restaurants is, like, sometimes I'll just get one of those salads with 8 vegetables in them. I mean, I have vegetables around my apartment, but I don't usually make 8 vegetable salads on a weekday night. It would make enough that you'd be eating it for 2 weeks. So little things like that.
Well, since you're not inventing these recipes, how obsessive are you in the hunt for the best recipe for, let's say, roast chicken or egg salad?
Well, I've hardly invented roast chicken, but the recipes in the book are actually originally my recipes. But, you know, original is a complicated thing. I did not invent roast chicken. But what I'm thinking about a lot with roast chicken is
Somebody
did, and I thank 5, them.
5,000 years ago.
Oh, I know. They just put it over a fire, and everybody was happy. But when I've been looking at a lot of roast chicken recipes over the years, because who doesn't love roast chicken every so often, is they take a long time. You know, you do the whole bird. Sometimes you have to trust them, and most people aren't going to do that on a weekday night. And let's say it's a freezing day in February and you would love to have roast chicken for dinner. Could it be done in under an hour? And from there, I learned about spatchcocking, which is this hilarious word where you just cut out the backbone of a chicken, and boom, I mean, a small chicken, you can do it in 30, 40 minutes.
Does it affect the flavor? Doesn't the bone give some flavor to
Absolutely.
The chicken?
Absolutely, and you still have a lot of bones in there, but the nice thing is it increases the skin surface area by being flat, that you get a lot more crisp skin, I think, with this method, and then you can save the backbone for stock. So you could do this 3 or 4 times, you put it in the freezer in a bag, and then you can use those to make stock down the road. It's very useful.
And you admit to going through 7 different muffin recipes before you landed on the plum poppy seed muffin recipe in the book. We happen to have that recipe on our show page at WNYC.org. Did you learn anything from the 6 muffin recipes that you rejected?
Yes. I learned that a lot of muffin recipes are really way too sweet. One of the things I'm always trying to do is try to keep muffins on the breakfast side of the breakfast cake line. And so if you're going to have something really sweet or with a ton of butter in it, it's just sort of like it's just cake. And I want to believe that it's breakfast. And so I discovered that, you know, thicker batters keep the fruit from sinking. So with thinner batter, you're going to have all that fruit in the bottom at the end. If you want it nicely interspersed, it's good to keep it a little thicker.
I wish some professional bakers knew that. You often wind up with a blueberry muffin with all the blueberries on the bottom.
So sad, because the muffin top is totally the best part, too. But in most cases, you can put in yogurt and at least a good part of whole wheat flour, and it still can taste really good without being overly austere, because you do want to treat once in a while.
Do you think it's important to share the failures with your readers as well as the successes?
Absolutely. Though these days I tend to couch it in, here are some things that went wrong on my way to getting here, rather than just leaving people at a dead end. But I love it, because I think that we all go through that. Or maybe people imagine that if you have successful recipes in a book that you've never had 15 flops on your wing to get there. And I mess up all the time in the kitchen.
What about your readers? They write back to you on your blog.
Very often.
Did they say, Deb, I tried this. Let me suggest another approach?
Let me suggest you go to cooking school and...
No, they're
so
not that mean.
Most of them are very lovely. So I'm very lucky. Most of the feedback is positive, but there are... I tend to feel like I'm playing doctor with symptoms when something goes wrong because I really want to figure it out because I want to know what's going on in people's kitchen. It's very helpful for me to hear why it did or did not work, but I often don't know when somebody says, this didn't work. I'm like, well, how? Tell me more.
Well, you began as an amateur. Did that help you keep an open mind when you started cooking?
I think so. I didn't have any idea of what a correct recipe was, I wasn't really concerned with the proper way to do everything. And in many cases, I find it helpful to know the correct way, but then you figure out where you can deviate from there.
And the correct way isn't always the correct way. Sometimes people will say, you know, the tradition is to sear the meat first or mm-hmm. to cook it on one side first and then on the other side, but maybe that's not always the best approach. We are still learning how to cook, despite the fact that humans have been doing it since before they developed language.
I agree. And I also think, you know, sometimes it's a matter of priority. Like maybe you don't care that much about whether it has that extra crunch from the searing. I think a good recipe writer is going to question all of those things. They're going to say, is this absolutely necessary? Can I make this both ways and take away the searing and see if we really miss it?
Did you learn from your parents?
I learned a lot from my parents. My mom definitely was she taught herself to cook through working her way through mastering the art of French cooking, which I love because it's such a classic. So I probably had an above average amount of quiche and asparagus in my life for a Jewish kid from New Jersey. But I learned a bit. My grandmother was very into baking. She was an excellent baker. But I think most of it I've just sort of figured out through trial and error because I'm actually really picky. And so it's sort of like I think I don't like something and then I challenge myself to make it in a way that I would.
You say that in your blog that you're wary of excessively fussy foods and or pretentious ingredients. That part of your pickiness?
I think that's part of it, but that's also part of my frustration with a lot of the recipes I read. I don't know when this became okay, but all of a sudden I feel like I read recipes all the time that say, use the best olive oil. I'm like, are you kidding me? We're frying an egg. The best olive oil should be used to finish a dish. Or in your own kitchen, you can make these choices. But the idea that you would make it a prerequisite for somebody to make your dish that they have some fancy sea salt, and I do have a couple that I'm quite soft for, too. But, you know, to really question whether table salt would work there, not to use the lowest common denominator ingredient so that more people can make it. And if they want to go swap in their favorite olive oil they brought back from their trip to Italy, they can. But it shouldn't be a prerequisite.
My guest is Deb Perlman. Her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, has become a major bestseller. As a picky eater, that means that there are certain things that you don't like to eat or have. I mean, you're writing cookbooks. So do you have to trick yourself into eating something that you wouldn't have eaten otherwise?
Yes, sometimes, but I didn't publish anything I didn't feel was a good result because there were things like I thought I didn't like meatloaf. Who likes meat? It's like this slab on a plate. But then I played with it and I realized they were kind of just like large meatballs. And that's actually how I ended up making it, kind of like large meatballs. So you have these individual servings and they don't have that brown slab look. And the flavor is, I actually really love it. So I converted myself through my challenge.
And what about fish? A lot of people have problems with fish.
This is like my deep dark shame is that I'm not the most enthusiastic fish eater.
Why? It's delicious.
I know. It's not logical. I don't actually think it tastes bad. It's just like it's totally beyond logic because obviously, you know, a beautiful piece of fish with brown butter and lemon juice. I'm not crazy. I know that's delicious.
Well, some people object to the smell when the fish is cooking.
I think that I can smell it even when it's super fresh and a million miles away. But the strangest thing is, you know, most people would say, I'm not really into fish, but I like salmon or shrimp. Those are the two things that I have the hardest time getting my head around. But I love, like, the things that most people don't like mussels and clams, and I don't even mind oysters. So I probably like the fishiest things.
And then we just learned in today's times that much of what is being called snapper isn't snapper.
Yes. I mean, when you can't see where your food's coming from, the idea that you can just trust it, unfortunately, hasn't been shown to be the case in many, many, many other foods besides this.
Well, okay, so let's say you had a recipe for snapper and somebody went to the local supermarket, bought something that was labeled Snapper, turned out to be something totally different. Isn't that going to ruin the recipe, or are all oily fishes alike in a sense?
I think that it depends on whether the recipe writer anticipated it, and of course what was being used as a replacement. Is it a consistent replacement? If you're a recipe writer and you know that a lot of Snapper is something else, it would do good to mention this in the head notes and also test it both ways.
In light of the success of your blog and the sales of your cookbook, can you consider yourself a food expert now?
Oh, God, no, not at all. I think the only thing I understand with anything more than the most pedestrian level of knowledge is maybe how people I talk to cook at home.
Well, you've said that there aren't bad cooks, there are bad recipes.
I think so. I think that a really good recipe, you should be able to walk into the kitchen with this recipe in your hand, know very little about cooking, and just follow it beginning to end and have something exactly like the recipe creator intended. That was what a good recipe should do.
So do you start off with the foods that you did love?
I start off with an idea. Sometimes it's a whim that just came to me when I was like staring at the window and supposed to be doing my work. Other times it's a thing I had at a restaurant that I really loved. And I don't want the chef's recipe. It's just like, wow, I hadn't even considered putting these two things together. And then I just like my – and sometimes it's just like, you know, I bet I would like meatloaf if it had this in it. And then I start playing. So it usually comes from a place of tinkering.
Do you think very seasonally? Most people, when they talk about seasonal things, they're thinking about the vegetables of the time. But does winter mean pastas to you? Or
absolutely. And we're definitely
– stews, beans?
Absolutely. Doing a lot more stews, beans. I feel like I eat more meat in the winter, too, just because, you know, it's much harder to base an entire it's absolutely possible, but it's a little trickier when the produce isn't that lovely to build an entire recipe, you know, entire meal around just a vegetable that's not so great right now.
And there are certain things that intimidate home cooks. How do you entice people to take the chance?
Well, I think that, you know, I know a lot of people are intimidated by homemade pasta, pie dough, tart doughs,
pizza
frosting.
Crusts.
Some people are intimidated by layer cakes. Whatever it is, I think if you know why it intimidates people, if you can figure out where it is that people are just like, you know, losing it, where they just – look, if you don't feel like there's any difference between the flavor of your favorite box cake mix and what you're making at home, absolutely do not bother yourself. This is not judgment. It's like, don't bother. It has to be worth it to you. But if you were thinking that there could be better, but you just think that all the recipes are too complicated or you've had so many that fall flat, that's where the place where a good recipe can come in.
One of the things that I like about the book is that you've done the meatless main courses separate from the meat dishes. I'm assuming that's because you were once a vegetarian, or you have thought about the plight of vegetarians?
I was a vegetarian for a very long time. I was a very opinionated 13-year-old, as I guess shouldn't be terribly surprising. And I was a vegetarian all the way until the time that shortly after I met my husband and he ruined me or something. But I
Well, you could have cooked for meat for him. And
well, he's actually totally okay. It's great because he's not like – you know, he's not like, oh, boy, we're having Brussels sprouts and potatoes for dinner. Like, he's not sad at all if we don't have – I mean, he loves me, but it's not like, you know. So he was going to eat either way. But I think it just – I started thinking, what do I not like about it? What would make me like it if I knew I could get clean meat ethically raised and I didn't eat it all the time and I made it in ways I'd like it? So it sort of came around that way. But because of that, I think my orientation towards meat meals has changed almost, hopefully permanently. I think it's a good thing because most of the time I'm not looking for meat when I'm making a meal. I'm looking for it as a once or twice a week or a special occasion kind of thing.
And in many ethnic cuisines, meat, when it is used, is really just another flavoring. Mm-hmm. It is not the dominant thing and dominant ingredient as it is in a lot of American cooking.
Absolutely. And that's a luxury, this idea of being able to have large pieces of meat for each person. You know, I always think of like with, I don't know, carnitas or like a pork shoulder, you know, which is stretched for many, many meals. Or I made some really good stuffed cabbage where, you know, you take the ground meat, you take like 1 pound or a third of a pound of meat and you stretch it to meals for many people, hearty, wholesome meals.
My guest is Deb Perlman, who's a self-taught home cook and photographer who created smittenkitchen.com, which started winning a lot of awards. It's a blog that then led to her cookbook, which includes only a few of the recipes that she has published on her blog. But the cookbook has become a major bestseller for Knopf, the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, Recipes and Wisdom from an Obsessive Home Cook. One of the reasons it's so popular is because of your text that goes along with the recipes. It's not just the recipes. And when we come back, we'll talk a bit about that. Okay?
Thank you.
And we're back with Deb Perlman, her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, a bestseller from Knopf, Recipes and Wisdom from an Obsessive Home Cook is the subtitle that Knopf gave you. I'm sure you didn't give them that, with lots of wonderful pictures. When you were here on the show last time, a listener named Sandy called in to ask a question or wrote into our show page that we couldn't get to it, but it is a very common question, so I'm going to ask it for her now. What are great weekday meals for a rushed household with kids that also incorporate vegetables that they'll eat?
Wow. I'm a big fan of making baked vegetable dishes, gratins. Now, I know when we think of gratins, we think of them oozing with cream and cheese. They absolutely do not need to be. They can be with broth. You can put a little bit of cheese in, or maybe just – there are a lot – it's basically just baked vegetables. And what's nice is when you do something like that, it's very delicious. It reheats really well. And you could make a pan of something with a lot of vegetables in the beginning of the week and use it throughout the week. I have – it's more rice-based, but I have a wild rice gratin in the cookbook, which is – it has kale and caramelized onions and a little bit of cheese, and it's with broth, not cream. And I just – we love making that. So now you have this hearty, healthy side dish for the whole week.
And you could take care of that kale that – seems to be proliferating
everywhere.
In every market.
Exactly.
And you say, what the heck do you do with that?
What did we do before kale? I think we just starved, I guess.
Well, most of the dishes you have in the book and in the blog are from scratch. Do you object to people cutting corners with things like canned beans or frozen peas?
Oh, my goodness. Not at all. I feel like as a recipe creator and a curious cook, I like to give people the tools to make things from scratch. But absolutely, I mean, you need to use pre-bought pie dough, or you just cannot bear to make your own pizza dough or whatever. It's individual choice, and I really resist and kind of resent the idea that somebody should be judged for that. Everybody picks what's important to them in the kitchen.
But do you think that making things from scratch does have a little difference when it comes to taste?
I think it does, but I think that not everybody is, you know, everybody's got their, you know, some people don't feel like there's a big difference in the pie dough when they make it, and so I'm obviously not one of these people. I think it tastes much better, but if you don't, then, you know, you shouldn't feel like you need to bother yourself with it just for somebody else's standards of what pie dough should be. But I also just also enjoy being in the kitchen. I'm not trying to create 30-minute recipes, not because I have no respect for your time, but because I actually enjoy the process. And I think if you'd like to be in the kitchen, you know, and there are ways that you can bring your family in and bring your kids in and enjoy it. You don't need to rush out of there.
Should invite our listeners to participate in this, because I know a lot of people have questions for you. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Also, you can reach us through Facebook. My guest is Deb Perlman. Her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, is from Knopf, and it's been a bestseller. Does that mean there'll be a follow-up?
I'm not working on a follow-up.
You're just doing the blog.
It's kicking off my second book tour for the book, so I'm going to be like all over the country in the next 2 weeks. So anyway, so I haven't even thought about it. Maybe one day, but I don't want to write another book just because it's time to write another book. I want to write another book because I have a really great book to write.
But there are only 100 recipes in the book, and in the blog you have many hundreds.
Yeah, there are over 800 recipes on the site and more each week.
So how did you decide which dishes to put into the book?
Sometimes it was very clear to me, like there was just something that just screamed book to me. And sometimes for me that was something where I thought it had more longevity, or maybe it didn't focus so much on an ingredient with a very short window of being in season and or that was hard to get. I love ramps. They're so delicious, but they're most people in the country can't get them. And even in New York, they have a very short window. And sour cherries is another thing. So I don't really, I wasn't terribly interested in putting them in the cookbook, even though I enjoy cooking with them.
So this isn't necessarily a reflection of your specific tastes and the trigger foods that you talk about.
Not necessarily. I mean, there are definitely things that don't show up on the site as much or in my recipes just because I feel like they're harder to get, or sometimes where I feel like the everyday quality is really quite different from what I'm getting and I don't want people to be disappointed.
Well, you have a whole section in the book on how to throw a dinner party that you will actually enjoy. That's a big problem, isn't it? Guests come and you wind up doing in the kitchen a lot while everybody else is having fun. It's hard to come up with something where you can also participate.
I agree. And I think that there's a lot of foods that can be made in advance and reheat really well. There are foods that taste better on the second and third day. And these are the places that I think you should go with your creative energies, unless you were trying to do something very fancy and highly ambitious. Most people I know are absolutely delighted to get invited over for meatballs and spaghetti, or let's make some deep dish pizza, or just like here's some short rib braise. You know, they've been settling for a day and you rewarm it and it's incredible. Like, this is that kind of comfort food. Most people aren't cooking at home, and this is a luxury just to have somebody make you dinner.
So you're saying that it's not important to show off.
No,
it's important
please.
To have the social experience.
Yes, I think showing
got
off.
Got that short ribs aren't a very special kind of dish.
Well, no, I think it can be special and have profound, intense flavor and be really wonderful meal without you maybe exhausting yourself to do something so ambitious that it was difficult for you, and therefore your enjoyment of it may not be as much.
Many, many New Yorkers complain about the size of their kitchen. Do you think there are advantages to cooking in a small kitchen?
I think there are, and this is like me chinning up about it, because I have a very tiny kitchen, and it's incredibly annoying, but...
Well, you started off with a tiny kitchen, then you moved to another place with a tiny kitchen? I would have thought you would have moved to a place with a bigger kitchen.
I make no sense at all. I know. There's no logic, so I'm not allowed to complain about it, because I did choose it. Nobody held a gun to my head and said I had to live in an overpriced apartment with a tiny kitchen. I liked the living room. So there you go. I liked the size of the bedroom. I liked the black and white tiles on the floor. So I'm not logical, but yes, my first kitchen the kitchen I had when I started the site was actually bigger. I moved to a smaller one, but I have found it useful in reining in my more complicated ideas, because as soon as something hits three bowls, like, forget it. I'm out of room and I'm getting stressed out and I'm not enjoying it.
What about other kitchen equipment? The mixers and the blenders and all of that stuff, toasters and I don't know.
I'm resistant to using them. I have
microwave.
Picked up, I don't have a microwave. I'm not like anti-microwave. It's a big box, and I just, for most things, I've found that I can just use the oven or use the stove, and so I just decided that was something I didn't want. I use instead the space I would have put the microwave in. I do actually have the mixer and all that stuff, but I don't take it down for everything. I've discovered that with like 95% of the things I would use a stand mixer for, I can really use an inexpensive hand mixer.
And a food processor?
I can't live without it. I think that you can live without it, but it saves you so much chopping, and you can make so many things in it so quickly.
You've been writing the blog for almost 7 years now. Has your approach changed over all that time?
Oh, my God. It's been almost 7 years. Sorry. You're right. I think it's gotten maybe I've become even more of a pain with the testing, because as the readership has grown, my worry about disappointing people has it's not that the early recipes aren't well tested, but I feel like things are far more rigorous now, and I'm a lot pickier with the results.
And when did you decide you had to quit your day job to devote yourself totally to this?
Well, it wasn't a hard choice. I wasn't very good at my day job. I'm sure they weren't like, that Deb Perlman, we've never been able to replace her. I'm sorry. I like to talk about it, because I think a lot of people, when you get out of college and you're just like, what am I going to do with my life? And I'm so bad at my job. I think this is like normal. And a lot of us have to bounce around a lot before we find something that we really love. Anyway, for me, it was like, because, you know, I was really working on the site every evening and on the weekends, and I was working all day. I had two jobs, but it was just a matter, for me, I didn't have a very fancy, or I wasn't like a six-year associate or anything like that. So I had a pretty paltry salary. So it was just about a matter of the site making more money than my day income was.
Well, there are a lot of people who started cooking blogs. Why do you think this one took off the way so many others haven't?
I think my mom pays everybody to hang out with me. It's really hard for me to see it from the outside. I know what I'm trying to do, but, you know, what it means to other people is, like, very hard for me to read. But I'm hoping that I'm putting out recipes that work, things that you're really wanting to eat that aren't too complicated.
But what are your readers telling you? I know you answer all of the emails that they write to you. You've been on tour. You say this is the second one, the book. Debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list for hardcover advice and miscellaneous. So you must be getting a lot of feedback.
I'm not that good with email these days, but I do try to respond to every comment that has a question in it. I'm hearing that I have friends who never cook. I mean, I mentioned in the introduction I have friends that use their ovens for sweater storage. And maybe it's just they're being nice because it's my book, but all of them are cooking now. And it really means a lot to me. They're making brisket on the weekends, and I'm hearing from them. So I'm hoping that maybe if you thought you were somebody who didn't really, who found cooking to be a little bit drudgery, maybe there were some ideas in there that made you immediately want to go to the kitchen and just make one thing.
What about the photography? Did that also... Is that something that you discovered you liked at the same time you discovered that you wanted to write about food?
No, the photography is much later. I really picked up a camera for the first time besides a point and shoot in 2005 when I borrowed my husband's camera, and I haven't given it back yet. Sorry. Not sorry.
I'm sure he's not sorry.
He's over it.
does he have to test all of the food that you're writing recipes for?
I don't think he minds that much, but yes, he does. It depends.
It was
yes.
Worth sacrificing a camera.
Yes. I gave it back to him when I upgraded, and he's like, thanks. the photography for me is secondary. I know what I'm trying to do with the photos. I don't really consider myself consider myself a fake photographer. I don't know anything about lights or metering, or my white balancing is atrocious. I'm trying to get sharp pictures of the food so you can see what it really looks like in my kitchen.
But you also have to make the food look good. There are people out there who do that for a living.
I know. I wish one of them would come over and make my photos look better. But you know what, though? I think food styling is amazing, and there are people who do incredible jobs, and I'm envious of their skills. At the same time, I feel like there's something to food the way we're actually serving it. You know, chicken on a dinner plate. Like, because that's how we're eating. That's how it looks at home. And if I were to put out something really ambitious and beautiful and maybe perfectly styled, your food wouldn't look like that. And how would that inspire you?
How
I feel disappointed.
How did you wind up at Knopf, which has this great tradition? Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, and Judith Jones. Did somebody spot the blog and say, Deb, we think you should give us a book?
I think what happened, I don't know the exact how it came happened at Knopf. And I know at a few of the publishers I visited, it was sort of like the editor maybe hadn't heard of it, but then they mentioned it to like their younger office assistant, and they were you have to get her in. And so I don't know if that's exactly how it went down, but I wouldn't have been surprised. And I don't know how I ended up there, but I've been so happy with them. So
where do you get inspiration for what recipe or dish you're going to tackle next? Does it start with thinking, what are we going to have for dinner?
It does. It starts with cravings. I've been, because I was away so much over the fall book touring, I've been home for a month and a half now, and I've been really cracking down on dinner. Like, I don't want to eat takeout. I don't want to. So I've been cooking a ton in the last month and a half. And a lot of it, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to throw some chicken in the oven. I'm just going to make a quick soup. And I can't help it. My brains are always spinning. I made a quiche, and I'm like, ooh, I have another, you know, so it spins into another idea. So lately my inspiration has been this stuff I've been cooking for dinner, just not trying to do anything fancy, but ideas come from there. But quite often it just comes from hunger or cravings or just whatever looked good at the store, which is not so much this time of year.
Do listener comments ever inspire a recipe?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite...
Or reader, I guess, comments. Yeah. I think in terms of listeners, but you have
maybe
readers.
I hope they're listening, too. one of my favorites is somebody told me they made... I have this thing called it. It's a chocolate loaf cake, and I call it the everyday chocolate cake, though. Sadly, I never get to eat it every day. Maybe it's for the best. Anyway, so she said that she didn't have buttermilk, and she used red wine, and that was it. I was like, she didn't even like it that much, but it didn't matter. I was like, I was halfway to the kitchen, and I love it. And there's actually a lot of chocolate red wine cakes. I want to say like maybe Northern France. I've heard about them. So they actually exist in cookbooks long before this. But I loved it with a pinch of cinnamon in there, and it makes a really delicious, really fun dinner party cake that's easy to make.
Well, people often drink red wine when they're eating chocolate or some chocolate dessert. So the pairing makes sense, but you're just putting them into the thing itself.
Exactly. What I love about the cake is I feel like it tastes equally of red wine and chocolate. The red wine is definitely, it is a background flavor, but it's present. And what you end up with is a very red chocolate cake. I consider it the real red velvet cake.
So are there things that you won't try? Do you stay away from breads, for example?
No, I love baking bread. In fact, I actually think it's a little bit absent from the book, but quite often, I'm really, when I'm making bread, I'm really using other people's recipes. I'm not a professional bread baker, and so I would use what Peter Reinhardt's doing or, you know, somebody who, Jim Leahy's bread. Like, I'm not really doing a lot of my own bread inventions, but I love making bread. But I don't make bread for a dinner party, and I don't make bread because it's Sunday morning. I'll make bread because... As an additional project.
Jim Leahy's No Need Bread has been a revelation for a lot of people.
I really like it.
Yeah, there's a layered crepe cake that you have in your cookbook. It's hard enough to make one crepe, let alone a stack of them. How did you crack the nut of making good crepes, a sequence of good crepes?
Well, my recipe anticipates that you are going to lose one or two, which is nice because you are the first. Because you're just like out of the rhythm. I feel like after you make two, though, you do get into the rhythm of it. However, I think that their crepes can really they can range, and there are very thin, lacy, delicate ones, and they are absolutely wonderful for somebody else to make. They are the most difficult to make at home without tearing. So I go for a batter that's just has a little bit more body in it, and I think the people find it a lot easier. So it won't be as thin as a filmy piece of lace, but it will also be something that I think you can pull off easily at home.
Now, we have three of your recipes on our show page. Plum poppy seed muffins, pancetta white bean and Swiss chard pot pies, and tre leche rice pudding.
Good choices.
I was hoping that you thought that they would be good choices, but there are so many we could have chosen from.
But those are good for this time of year. That white bean pot pie, you know, it's just so great as a cold winter meal. It's really like a nice stew. It's vegetarian. Sorry, there's pancetta in it. The pancetta is optional. If you eat it, go ahead, throw it in. If you don't want to, it's still a nice
white
bean
stew. Can
you
put something else in that will capture that same kind of salty meat flavor?
I think you can, but I always have a hard time. I get this question a lot, like, what's bacon like but not bacon? I'm like, I don't know. You can use a fake bacon, but I would be more likely to maybe just add some smoked paprika, you know, for a little bit of the smoky saltiness. There are definitely ingredients that some people feel work. I haven't found one that I feel is a arguable good replacement, but I also made that recipe both ways, and we really liked it with or without it.
The book is The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. Been a bestseller for how long now? A while. When was it published?
It came out October 30th. I think it was on for 10 weeks, maybe more. And then if I say I lost track, I sound like such a jerk, but I might have lost track. Sorry.
Well, you can find it at your local bookstore. It's published by Knopf. And Deb, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me back.